Welcome to Novels with Nightcaps, a podcast where we talk about all things bookish while sipping on some nightcaps. I'm Allie.
And I'm Melinda.
And this is the first episode of season two. We're really excited to kick off another season of talking about our favorite things, books and booze. And tonight, we're going to be discussing recent reads by our standout author choices from our season one, episode six, holiday special, where we discussed standout reads from 2020 during quarantine. But first, let's find out what we're drinking from our resident bartender and producer. Mr. Producer, take it away. What are we drinking tonight?
Well, tonight, Allie is drinking a Celtic Crossing, which is a cocktail of my own invention.
And has nothing to do with the books that we're reading tonight, just so you know.
It does not. It's just a tasty cocktail I thought you would enjoy.
Why, thank
you. It is so named because it has Irish whiskey and Scotch whiskey in it. So, and, you know, Scotland, Ireland. Apparently the Celtic Crossing is how you get between the two. Who knew? But yeah, it's Scotch and Jameson and ginger and honey and lemon. It's tasty.
Yep, so, it is.
And then Melinda had never had a French 75, so I have her drinking a French 75, which I know is one of your faves, Allie.
It is, yeah. I can't believe she's never had one because she loves bubbles so much.
I know. How do you like it, Melinda?
Not Trailer Park Boys bubbles, but... actual like drinking bubbles.
Champagne bubbles.
That kind of bubbles is good too.
Or the Powder Puff Girls bubbles. I don't. Wherever
also
your brain
a solid
went.
Choice.
Yeah.
But I love it. I think it's so good. I'm surprised I've never had one. So
that's
I'm
my,
excited to
good.
Continue making it.
Yeah, that's my go-to order when I want to feel fancy.
I will feel fancy until I say it, and then it'll sound different. So
yeah, how does it sound with the Kentucky accent?
So it's gonna be a French 75, and that's just not
75.
It's just not. It's fine.
I like it. I think it sounds great.
Backwoods.
If anybody
ordering
listening's
a fancy
never
drink.
Had one, it is gin and lemon juice and sugar and champagne. So
sugar
all things
water.
That are good, and it's tasty. And yeah, that's what we're drinking today.
Nice. And thank you for now, that Men in Black reference. Yeah. Randomly.
Now we can talk about some books now. Back to you two.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But before we get started, we want you to follow us on Instagram, Novels with Nightcaps, and on whatever, wherever you watch podcasts, watch. Yep, that's what you do.
Do it.
We listen to podcasts.
Do it, or we'll choke you and not,
follow
in,
us.
Not in a good way.
Not in the fun way. You can follow us on those, like us, you know, pass it on to your friends. But we also have some fun things in the making. So Mr. Producer is making us a YouTube channel and a new website. And he's designed like a lot of merch. And so we will be hopefully doing some giveaways and things like that in the near future with our merchandise.
Exciting.
I'm very excited. I really do hope that Dolly for Dictator makes it on one of the things.
Yes, we have a lot of merch ideas based on previous episodes, and that is definitely a front runner, I think.
To be honest, there are way too many good ideas to do all of this. You guys gave me a lot to work with, which is great. I have a wealth of options. There's no way we're going to be able to do all of it all at once, at least. So
great. I don't know. I think the viewers, listeners, they should go to Instagram, message Mr. Producer through the DMs, tell him what kind of merch you want. Tell him you want all the merch.
Yes. And we can do the story where people vote.
Oh, yeah.
Except for that, we will just tell Mr. Producer that, well, they voted for all of them. 100%. Yeah. They just wanted all of them. So sorry.
Yep. Sorry. You got to make them. Is what it is.
Did you know that Mr. Producer has a real job? And we're just like, make all these things for us anyway. And I do nothing. Allie does a lot of work. And then I'm just here. I just show up. That's my whole contribution.
No, you're also the mediator. You're like the... You're the diplomat keeping the peace between
that's
me and the producer, aka my husband.
that's actually like my personality type. So for the Myers-Briggs,
it is.
I am the diplomat, so it's a good place for me to be. Okay, so I guess we should actually talk about the books.
So last year, so in 2020, I read my first Kazuo Ishiguro novel, and that was Never Let Me Go, which became like one of my favorite books of 2020. And Melinda, you had like a couple favorite books, but I think we went with an author that you wanted to read more of, right?
Yeah, and I think Betty was a debut, so
Yeah, Betty was your favorite, but yeah, I don't think there are any other books by her yet. So, we went with Kate Morton.
Yes,
for you. Melinda's gonna be talking about The Clockmaker's Daughter, and I will be talking about The Remains of the Day, which is another one of Ishiguro's famous books, and then also his latest book, which is Clara and the Sun. So I guess I will just jump right into our first book.
Tell us what they're about.
Yeah, so originally I actually did not think I was going to finish The Remains of the Day because I just wasn't feeling it. It was taking me forever to read, even though it's a pretty short book, but it kept dragging on for me, and I set it down, and then eventually I just came back to it and pushed through. I don't feel like it was necessarily a favorite for me, but I understand why people love it so much. I think for most people, either their number one Ishiguro book tends to be Never Let Me Go or The Remains of the Day. So that's kind of why I went into this as like my second book by this author, because it is such a beloved book by him.
So what was the main difference between the two? Why do you think they are?
So they're very different. Like the Remains of the Day is, there's nothing really set. I mean, well, yeah, there's nothing sci-fi about it. Like Never Let Me Go, I think is definitely more, I don't know. I guess it feels weird calling it sci-fi, but it does have that like sci-fi element to it.
Yeah.
That's kind of like unexpected. Whereas
it's also devastating.
Yeah, so. And devastating. Yeah, yeah, very sad. Which this book is also sad in like a different way, but it didn't have any kind of like surprise element like that, which I kind of kept waiting for and expecting to happen. Mm-hmm. But it was a lot more kind of straightforward. And I think in terms of like what it has in common with Never Let Me Go is that, and I know this is something that Ishiguro is known for, is like the whole kind of unreliable narrator thing.
Yeah.
So you definitely have that going on where it's like you're not exactly sure of what's happening. Just because you're seeing everything from one person's perspective. Never Let Me Go is like a different kind of, like that book was actually like devastating. Like it actually like broke my heart. Whereas like this book was depressing, but like in a way that it was just not my brand of depressing that I personally like. It was more like, hey, I wasted my life kind of doing this job that is meaningless, and that's fine.
It was off-brand.
Yeah.
Off-brand depression. We're not here for that. But I think Never Let Me Go is heartwarming, too.
Yeah.
It's like devastating and heartwarming, and it's a bizarre mashup of feelings. So
yeah. I mean, he's an excellent writer, so like you can't fault the writing here. Like the writing's definitely great. And I appreciate like what he was trying to do. Like, I think the takeaway was really, you know, showing the regret that comes with living a life for someone else instead of living it for yourself, which I guess you kind of get those sorts of themes, like in Never Let Me Go, and also in the other book that I'll be talking about, like his latest novel. So that's obviously like a trend that he really likes to focus on, like this whole kind of, you know, making you think about the meaning of life, basically. And for me, when I was reading this book, it reminded me of like one of those cheesy entrepreneurial quotes that says like building your own life, you know, or build your own life or someone else will build it for you. You ever seen that? Like on like Pinterest or
Instagram? Yeah, and we know how I feel about that shit. I am not here for any of that.
You're not here for the hashtag girl boss.
Nope. I'm not a chuggy or whatever that word is. Is that how you say it? Oh my God. Do I know something before you?
I'm very excited. I have no idea what that is. You're going to have to educate me.
So apparently they call millennials, certain female millennials are called chuggies now.
What?
I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but it's C-H-E-U-G-Y.
What does it even mean?
And I only know about it. I literally have no idea, but girl boss was one of the things. If you own a thing that says girl boss, that's one of the things for it.
So if you're part of like an MLM, you're like a chuggy.
Probably. let me Google it.
Even feel comfortable saying that word without knowing if it's like some kind of slur.
Out of date or trying too hard. Oh, ouch. Okay. Hmm. Yeah. So that's what. And that's why it's like, applied to millennials.
You're wearing skinny jeans and you have a side part, so you're trying too hard and you're out of date.
I guess. That or just, you know, girl boss thing. You're trying too hard to be, to pretend like you are better than you are, I guess.
Interesting.
I don't know. I saw one thing about it and I'm like, I'm an expert. I know what it means.
I'm going to have to look that up on Urban Dictionary later or something. That's where I get my internet sling.
I follow that guy. It's me, Rod.
Oh, yeah.
Who works with a friend of ours. And I follow him and he does the Millennial Weekly Recap where he lets us know what we're supposed to know.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, thank you for actually
keeping us in the
because
know.
Because I'm like, I do need to know. I feel like you're young enough. I'm too old. Like, I can't adapt.
What, like a 4-year difference?
But for some reason, it's a huge deal. But yeah, so that's the only reason I know it. It's because he did like a story. One of his stories was about shoegaze.
Now I feel like you're saying shoegaze. Which is a major throwback. All right. How did we get here? Yeah, so.
I don't know.
Yeah. The whole building your own life thing. I feel like that was very much like a theme throughout this. For me, the biggest problem that I had with this, and it's not even like, it's just like a personal problem. It's not like a critique of the author or anything really. It's more that like I am just not interested at all in anything that is about like British aristocracy. Like I don't watch Downton Abbey. I'm not into that stuff, which is not going to come as a surprise to anyone. Melinda made me read.
I was going to say
earlier, or I guess it was last year, probably, or earlier this year.
Yeah.
And I actually kept having flashbacks to that book while I was reading this book, which was really weird for me because I was not expecting this to be like any kind of like historical fiction, really. And I would say, and this isn't to like put Kate Morton down in any way, but I feel like those are two very different categories. Like I would categorize her more as like pop historical fiction and like,
yeah, absolutely.
And like Ishiguro as like literary fiction. So I was not like going into his book, like expecting to be reminded of hers. But there were a lot of times, like, I actually was getting the plots confused in my mind because I was literally thinking back to that Kate Morton book. I can't even think of the title of it right now. The book
House at Riverton.
House at Riverton, yeah. And how a big chunk of that book was like from the perspective of the housekeeper. And so a lot of the plot, at least in like the first half, is very driven by her like world that is this world of like being part of a big like housekeeping team in an estate, because that was, you know, the thing back then. Like you had like a whole staff of people that were serving the family and hosting events and that sort of thing. And so the main character in this book, he is a butler, and he comes from like a lineage of butlers, which is a thing in England.
Yes.
So like
will his be forever weird.
Yeah. Very strange. But you know, it's like considered to be a noble profession, or was, still is, I guess. I don't know if it still is a thing really. but his father was basically recognized as this, as one of like the most prominent butlers, I guess, of his time. And so the son feels like he has to live up to those expectations. And eventually, so he is serving this estate, which eventually gets bought by an American. And so, and I think that's why I also was thinking of Kate Morton's book.
Yeah.
Because the same thing. It's like a British staff that then the estate is bought by Americans. And so like their whole traditional ideas of what that whole life of serving consists of is shaken up by the Americans that are like, we do things
Americans are bad news.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we're bad news. And
well, they come in and it's just like they want servers, but they want it to be in like their own like new way. Like we're like, you know, it's like we're the cool mom or whatever. Like we're the cool, like cool head of the estate. Like we don't, you know, make our servers like act like robots, but we still want them to be around to wait on us hand and foot.
But still dust this whole place.
Yeah.
Like immediately.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you can call me by my first name, but clean everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a lot of that in this book where it's like this internal struggle conflict that he's like going through of, you know, being this very traditional butler who's having to adjust to his new boss who is American and has a very different perspective on things. And basically his boss tells him to go on a vacation because he never takes one, never takes time for himself. He's like, what is that? You know, the American being very new and hip is like, yeah, take a vacation, go do your own thing. Here, you can take my car and go on a road trip. So that's basically what he does. But it's not very like, it doesn't really have like road trippy vibes, which I was kind of hoping it would. It's more so a lot of like flashbacks. So like as he's traveling, he's just, it goes through a lot of him flashing back to moments of his life where he felt like he's kind of recalling like whether or not he was good at his profession, which is basically all like leading up to this feeling of regret toward the end of the book. It's like, it's basically him like giving himself a pep talk throughout this whole thing of like, I was good at my job. Like just telling.
And isn't that depressing?
Yeah. Like telling himself like, over and over again, like trying to convince himself that he was good at his job so that he doesn't feel terribly depressed about like all the shit that he gave up to be a butler.
And isn't, and that's like one of the things that we in America fight like to change the narrative mm-hmm. of is that you are not your job.
Right.
Like that's a whole thing now.
Although we're not very good at that here. I mean, we act like we want to be good at it, but
yeah, but we're not. Well, like my mom just retired and mm-hmm. she said that it's like really hard for her to be retired because she's like, my whole life was being an educator.
Yeah.
My whole life.
It's like your identity like, you know, is wrapped up in your career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to which I said, that is not a thing from which I suffer.
French of you, actually, because I remember my freshman year of college taking like a French course where we like talked a lot about French culture. And that was like the biggest thing that they tried to drill into our heads was that the French do not have like this whole problem of feeling like they work to live instead of living to work, which is what a lot of Americans do. Like when you meet an American, like one of the first questions is, what do you do? And like we were taught in this class, like that's not really a thing in France. Like that's not one of the first questions you would ask somebody.
And that's like a whole thing with the generation after us, is that they're trying to change that narrative. So like when you meet someone, they're trying to be like, you don't ask them what they do because that's not the make of them. It's like, what do you enjoy? What, you know, that kind of thing.
Although I would also say like a lot of that is happening for kind of a depressing reason, which is the gig economy, which is a good and a bad thing. Like gig economy, you have more personal freedom to kind of be your own person. But on the flip side of things, it's really hard to make a living just doing odd jobs here and there. So
absolutely. Yeah, we can't win for losing over here.
Exactly. So, yeah, it was just really hard for me to get into the kind of subject matter. And again, like I think like thinking back to the house at Riverton, that was kind of a big theme throughout that book as well, where she talks about like her life being a housekeeper. But there's a different outlook on it, which was that, you know, at the end, they're like, they're basically making a movie about this woman's life. And
well, yeah, because for her, at least, that wasn't like her goal. She became like a lot of other things, like an archaeologist and all that.
Yeah, she eventually like stopped that career and like went in a different direction and did different things with her life. And she didn't give up like having a family and, you know, a marriage and things, which that's kind of like one of the things with people who work as
staff.
Yeah, I was like, what is the word for that exactly? For like the female equivalent of a butler. I don't know. Like, yeah,
she's a housekeeper. In that time.
So the expectation, if you were like on a staff like that, was that you give up having like any kind of personal life. Like you don't have kids, you don't get married. And that's just the way it is because you live to serve the family that you work for.
In America, that's nannies.
Right.
Because here, like when we first moved to Chicago, I looked for a nanny job because I was a nanny forever. Mm-hmm. And you can make six figures. They pay you like $150,000 a year. That's your salary. Mm-hmm.
And you're getting probably like free room and board too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you can, you know, depending on the family that's hiring you, obviously they do nanny shares, which is much more affordable and whatever.
You're more of a au pair.
Yeah. Go on vacations, do all that kind of stuff. And I was like, fine, I don't mind doing that. But the minute you have a kid, like if you get pregnant and you're a nanny, they're like, you gotta go.
Yeah.
So like you have to never want your own kids.
Right.
If that's what you're going to do. Cause like you can't possibly take care of my kids if you have your own kid.
Right.
Which is a bizarre mindset, but it's fine.
I guess the house at Riverton, you were kind of seeing like the female perspective, whereas in this book, it was like from the male perspective, but same thing, like he never got married, he never had kids, he, you know, never had his own family, and we're seeing him like at, you know, during the end of his life, basically looking back and trying to justify the choices that he made to himself more than anything. At the end, he's like having a conversation with somebody on a train, like it's a stranger, but it's more so like him kind of reconciling with himself. but he's like explaining his life to this stranger. I think just reading about people who like kind of, you know, sacrifice everything, give up their own happiness and personal relationships, and justify it as ambition. It's, yeah, in order to serve those that were just like deemed part of a more important class, it's just depressing to me, which, you know, was kind of the point of this book, but that's what made it difficult for me to get through. And whereas like Never Let Me Go was also depressing, but
in a totally different, totally different way.
Yeah. And lots of like twists and turns and you're like, wow, like what?
Yeah.
What is happening? Didn't see that. Yes, exactly.
Did not see that coming. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's weird, like, because what did you give up your life for? You don't make enough money for your, like, retirement to be some, like...
I mean, for them, it's, like, all about the kind of notoriety, I guess, that comes with it. Because for him, that was really what he kept pointing to, was like, oh, well, I was such a good butler. Like, my dad, you know, was a renowned butler. And I, you know, did what I had to do. Like, that was kind of what he kept... That was how he justified it, was basically like he had to do this. Like everyone in Britain, like, I mean, he was very into the whole class system. So he's very, you know, we all have a purpose and a place. And that was his philosophy, was that, you know, he was just serving out his role that he was kind of given in life. It's sort of like anti-free will.
Yeah,
like you're born into a certain position, and so he very much like felt that it was his duty.
Yeah, well, that's like reminds me, I don't know, I think that mindset is the same as like that that Anna Kay, is that her name? Whatever that thing was where the girl gets scammed because she's friends with my friend, Anna, whatever.
Oh, you're mixing it. Okay, yeah. I was picturing there's
no, Anna Kay is...
I was picturing...
That's a totally different book.
That's a totally different book. You're talking about My Friend, Anna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My Friend, Anna. sorry.
We read and talked about on a previous episode.
Yeah. But it's reminding me of that because it's that same kind of mindset where, like, she was willing to do all kinds of things that you're like, you're stupid and don't do that. And you would, and you know not to do that. Because she wanted to be associated with this woman who is this socialite and had and supposedly had a lot of money and had a name and had some kind of cachet in New York society. And it's the same kind of thing where it's like, I'm a butler and I feel like I'm not super important, but I am attached to this other family that's very important.
Right.
And that's a sad way to live.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, it is. And part of how this all sort of plays out when he takes this trip to see a woman who previously worked for him, who, I mean, I guess, I don't know if this is really that much of a spoiler, but they were in love and he was kind of not oblivious to it, but obviously never acted on it because of his position. So he basically let her go and she chose to go, you know, get married and have a life. And so then, of course, that kind of stirs up these feelings of like, what if? Like, what if I had, you know, chosen a different path? But he doesn't really think about it that deeply because he's spending so much time just justifying his decisions to himself that, you know, he really doesn't get that sad about it until the very end when he's talking to the stranger. And the stranger is, you know, like, can you please stop, like, awkwardly crying on telling me your life story? So, yeah, it wasn't my favorite, but I get what he was trying to do with it. I'm sure probably at the time, like, I don't even know when this book came out. Like, it came out a long time ago, and so maybe, you know, maybe it would have been more revolutionary to me at the time that it came out. It's just, I think, because I've read things like this.
Well, you know me, I love an aristocrat story.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd probably like it, actually.
I just like anything that doesn't happen in modern day. That's my Give me a book that doesn't take place in modern day time, and I'm like, this is great. Even if it's taking place in like the 80s, which I was technically alive in for a short period. For half of it. For half of that decade I was around. But yeah, so I might like it.
Yeah.
Which would just carry on my love of that author now. So
yeah. There's a lot of I think something that bothered me a lot about Stevens, the butler, was just like how oblivious he was to things, but like kind of consciously oblivious. Like it was like he was choosing.
Like ignored it.
Yeah. Like there were a lot of like moments where, you know, he was like, I don't know how to act with these Americans, for instance. Like how do I be funny? So like he was like practicing like how to be humorous, like in conversations with Americans and like just weird things like that. Like the whole, you know, this woman who's obviously interested in him, he never really like, he acts as if he just has no clue and shows like zero interest in her. Like every time she is, you know, basically like, what the hell is wrong with you? Why do you not give a shit about this? Because toward the end, she's like, I'm leaving. Like, I'm going to go get married. And he literally shows, like, no emotion about it. Because he's like, I am a butler. Like, I cannot I cannot show emotion. He was like, I need to tend to these important men having a conversation in the other room. I don't have time to hear about your engagement. And she's like, you really don't care that I'm getting engaged and I'm leaving forever? Like, okay, bye. Like, peace out.
When does this take place?
So it takes place during he takes his trip in 1956, but that would be in his older age.
Even so.
Yeah.
Even so, like when I think that's part of what it is I do not have a grasp of time. Like I have no grasp of time as it passes, all that stuff. So I, in my mind, when I'm reading those books, I'm like, this is a long ass time ago. And then it'll be like 1940. And that's really not like, you know, it's really not that long ago in the grand scheme of things. Right. And it's weird to me that when you talk about it, I'm like, okay, so that is weird. That is weird. Cause that's like,
yeah.
He's not like a butler in 1764. Like he's a butler.
Yeah.
And there's a 1-9 before the date. I don't know. Before the year. It just
It
stresses me out a little. We should have been way past it by that.
Yeah.
That time.
Yeah. It kind of shows like, I mean, how far behind, I guess, England was. Like how they were trying to really hold on to those traditions. And they didn't really start to lose their grasp on them, I think, until around World War II, and that kind of forced them to have to change the way that they operated. And I think that's when you get like a lot of these stories such as this one, where it's the situation of like an American taking over a British household. Like there was, I guess, a lot of that probably during that time period. And so a lot of traditions being challenged and people having to change their viewpoints on things. Like they do talk about like World War II and this somewhat, and like whether or not the guy who originally owned the estate, like whether or not he was pro-Nazi or something, I think. Yeah, it was there was like this section in which they kind of like go into like Stevens the butler is talking to someone who's trying to convince him that their boss was like not that great of a person, because he's kind of like, oh well, because I'm a butler, I have to forever like stand up for my employer and not ever, you know, criticize them at all. And this person is basically saying, well, they weren't actually that great. And like they fired like some of the Jewish staff. Like, how can you act as if like you had no idea? And it kind of goes back to that whole like this character being so oblivious, because he chose just not to see those things. Yeah. It wasn't like he didn't know that. He was just like, oh, they were fired because they were Jewish? Like, I thought they got fired for some other reason.
But dude, if you're the butler, you're in charge of all that stuff anyway. That, at least that was my understanding. So you had to know why they were fired. Boo.
Okay, so Ishiguro's latest book, which is his first novel that he's written since winning the Nobel Prize in 2017. So this is kind of unlike Remains of the Day. This is more of like a darker dystopian sci-fi, similar to Never Let Me Go. So that was nice because that was the whole reason I just we did this, where we picked up books from one of our new favorite authors from last year. And Never Let Me Go is my favorite book of 2020. So it does have like the same unreliable narrator theme that we see throughout all of his writing. But unlike in Remains of the Day, where, you know, we're dealing with a very formal butler, Claire and the Sun, we're seeing everything through the eyes of an artificially intelligent teen who is created to be a companion of sorts for human teenagers. So in this world, AIs have been designed to provide friendship for privileged children until they go off to college. And as such, they're referred to as artificial friends, or AFs for short.
gives a whole new meaning to privileged kids' parents buying them friends. That's like a whole.
Yeah. And I think part of this is because the kids are kind of isolated in a way, which I'll sort of get to. And just bear with me, everybody listening, because this description of this book is very bizarre. Like, it was very hard to like kind of wrap my mind around, which is probably better that we're recording this now and not when I was in my like drunken allergy medicine state since last time. This is not an easy book to explain. So luckily I have not had that much to drink yet. So anyway, so this kind of reads a little bit like YA, and I actually had to look up whether or not I was reading YA, since I wasn't sure, because it's almost written to be a bit like Toy Story or something like that, because you're seeing the world through the playthings point of view, which if you've seen Toy Story, you know, it's bound to get depressing because kids do not stay kids forever. And at times, because it's written from this playthings point of view, it can make the story feel a little simplistic, but it's like deceptively simplistic, because you're seeing things through the eyes of this like very innocent character, you sort of lose sight of all the more like sinister things that are at play in the background. So anyway, we start off in an artificial friend store, which is where Claire lives with other AFs while she's waiting to be picked by a child. And through this process, we learn that Claire is a B2 model, meaning she's not as technologically advanced as some of the newer B3 models. But what she lacks in advancement, she makes up for in her ability to be incredibly observant and empathetic. Or at least as empathetic, I guess, as a robot can be.
Right.
And this is important because of these special traits that she has. She's eventually picked by this young, sick girl named Josie and her mother. And she's chosen because of these traits and observational skills. And the mother actually tests Clara's like ability to mimic Josie's mannerisms, which is like put her to the ultimate test of how observational she really is. And yeah, I don't think they ever really explain like what Josie is sick with or how old she is exactly, but Claire kind of describes her as being like a preteen because she's very busy all the time with school and prepping for this day that she's going to go off to college. So anyway, Josie wants Claire to decide for herself whether or not she wants to go home with her. And while she is trying to convince her that she'll love her new home. She does also warn her that everything is not as it seems, meaning that it's not all rainbows and butterflies, despite her family's wealth and affluence. So they do live in this really nice house, but there's definitely some things going on behind the scenes. And Clara agrees that she wants to go home with Josie, and she adapts to this new role of being Josie's caretaker and companion. I say caretaker to, like, to some extent, it's more that she's just like watching over her. She's not really, you know, like nursing her, because there is like an actual housekeeper there who does those sorts of things. And the housekeeper is actually really like resentful of Clara's presence in the house. So that's a whole other like dynamic that's going on. But that's kind of, it's kind of revealed that it's just the housekeeper doesn't really trust artificial intelligence. And you see a lot of that in this world of like, people are still kind of getting used to the idea of artificial intelligence, like interacting on a day-to-day basis with humans. So again, like, we don't know like what the time period is or really the world that this is set in, although I think it is supposed to be our world, because at one point they referenced the housekeeper's family being from Indiana. Just super random. Yeah. Shout out to Indiana, me and Melinda's home state. So yeah, I think it is supposed to be the same world. I think it's just set off in distant future, but I'm not sure how distant. And kind of interesting the time that it was written in. It's kind of timely with all the weird apocalyptic stuff going on with COVID and all of that. So anyway, she basically watches over Josie and is just making sure that she's okay. And, you know, like alerts her mother if she seems really ill or anything like that. And kind of going along with what I said about like the kids seeming really isolated. So Josie has one neighbor, and that is her best friend, Rick, who she grew up with. And their relationship seems really strange from the beginning, because they're described as being each other's only neighbors since they live in this really rural area. And they're basically separated by this really large field. And they both live with their mother, like single mother situation, which Josie's father is somewhat in the picture, but doesn't live with them. But Rick's father, I don't think they ever mention him. So anyway, they have grown up together their entire lives. They plan to get married. They have like this whole plan of like growing old together, even though they're, you know, like 12, 13, I don't know.
And have met no one else ever.
I mean, they do have like, this is another weird thing. Like they have these like social events that are supposed to prep them for college. And so at Josie's house, because you're basically this, the way they kind of portray their home is that, or homes, I guess, plural, the way they portray it is that Josie lives in this really like stately manor, and where they like host big events, and like Rick kind of lives in just like a normal, modest kind of falling apart house on the same property.
Okay.
So there's this big contrast between both of them. Like he's very much like the more like destitute and not privileged, and she's living in this like really fancy mansion with, you know, all of these opportunities ahead of her, which you'll find out why she has those opportunities as it gets further into the story. It's all very complicated.
Mind has ended this story in so many ways already. Yeah. Like, I'm like, okay, that's what's gonna happen. Nope.
Yeah. Nope. And I'm curious if like you can kind of guess like the direction that this is going in, because I thought I knew how it was going to go, and then it kind of played out differently, but I'm not going to spoil it entirely. So
I can tell you right now, it feels like Clara's going to replace Josie. Like, that's what it feels like to me. I'm like, ugh. Okay.
No comment. Okay, so moving on. Josie. So yeah, Josie has these like events and everything. So she does know, and these are like strictly for her to socialize more with other peers, like her same age, but they all come from the city. So like when they have these events, like at her house, like these kids are all driving in from like far away to like come to her house for these events that are specifically just for like the kids to interact with one another, because in this world, like where this takes place, they don't have a lot of socialization. So it also kind of like leads you to think, well, isolation could be because of like technology and stuff. Like we've just gotten, like everything is online, because that's basically how they make it sound, like school is online. So Josie doesn't actually go to a school physically. Like she does all her schoolwork with like tutors and professors on her tablet or whatever she uses. So these events are just strictly for them to get the socialization. And there's actually like, and it's sort of like the opportunity for them to show off like a little bit too. So whoever's hosting, it's like, come to my house, like see how wonderful everything is. Meet my new artificial friend. Isn't she cool? And then the other kids are really mean and they all like bully each other and are really mean to Clara.
Sounds like every book about boarding school I've ever read.
Yeah. I'm wondering if the author like went to boarding school, because Never Let Me Go is the same, mm-hmm. had the whole same boarding school theme.
Yeah.
And this also has like the same kind of like love triangle in a way, like friendship triangle thing going on with the kids. So anyway, so we meet Rick. Initially he's like unnerved by Clara, because we learn that children in the society have been segregated into two categories. So there's lifted children and unlifted children. And the latter, so unlifted children do not have artificial friends, at least typically. I don't think it really says there's like a hard and fast rule about this, but it's just, you learn that only lifted children go to university traditionally. So they're kind of the ones that would be in a position to be more likely to get an artificial friend to help them prepare for college. So it's never like fully explained what being lifted means, but the clues throughout the story indicate that lifted children have been genetically altered to be intellectually superior. And
I thought that might be it.
Yeah. And so, and Rick's parents made the decision not to have him lifted. So it's up to the parents whether or not they choose to have their children lifted. And we discover that there's a price to pay sometimes for choosing to go forward with this genetic altering. But parents typically choose it, you know, because in this world, that's really the only way your child has a real future and an opportunity to attend university. And they talk about, there's only like really one prestigious school that accepts like a really small percentage of unlifted students each year, which they refer to as Rick's like only chance at a real future, because if he can't get into that school, then he can't get into any school basically. So over time, especially when like Josie's having these events and like her, you know, friends, if you can call them that,
her peers.
Yeah. Her peers are like being really mean to Clara. And this kind of helps Rick, open up to her a bit, and become more protective of her as he like sees her as an outsider similar to himself. Because everyone views him in that way as well. And that's something that like Clara observes when she first meets Rick and doesn't really fully understand, because from her perspective, he looks like all the other kids. And she doesn't understand like why the other kids are kind of mean to him and why the parents are like very hush hush. And it's basically because they're like judging him in a way like, ooh, his his parents decided like not to alter him. Like,
yeah.
Like, why would you do that? You know? And they kind of hint at it being like selfish a bit, because they also, again, they don't really go into a lot of detail, but his mother has health issues. It seems to be mostly like mental health issues, but she has trouble like taking care of herself. So she's pretty dependent on him. And so they kind of hint at that being like a selfish decision that she made to like kind of keep him around so he wouldn't be able to leave, even though, you know, she claims that has nothing to do with it and that she wants him to go out there and like have a future. You know,
so in this world, getting lifted doesn't cost money, I'm guessing.
They never say. Okay. So there's really, they don't discuss the process. They don't even explain what it is necessarily. You just kind of can put the pieces together and figure out that it is something to do with genetic altering, because it doesn't always go as planned. And gotcha. Some of them who get lifted end up getting really sick, like Josie and Josie's sister that you find out at one point did exist. We start to see this like, there's like this, she's innocent, but also not emotionless, but it's kind of like, it's similar to the butler and the butler Stevens, like I was saying, in like Remains of the Day. And you see kind of a similarity in that, like both characters maintain this kind of loyalty and devotion to their craft and their life purpose, like no matter the cost, especially like the personal cost that comes with it. And as Clara like begins to earn more trust from Josie's mother, the story begins to reveal to us what Clara's bigger purpose is. And that's about as far as we can really go with that, without spoiling it. And yeah, so I mean, like, there's a lot left up in the air in regards to like all the unanswered questions and the world building. It leaves a lot up to the reader's interpretation. And I think Ishiguro does this because his writing style does lend itself more so to creating suspense and drama rather than designing like this really elaborate world. Yeah. So it does leave a lot up to the reader's imagination. And I think you kind of see that in Never Let Me Go too. Because I don't know if you watch like the movie adaptation, I know it's not necessarily like what people pictured. You can definitely interpret it like in a lot of different ways. So yeah. There's not a lot of detail put into the setting and like how everything looks. But you just get that very like boarding school feel from it. And say bleakness level is very much on par with Never Let Me Go. And I've also heard it's really similar to his novel, The Buried Giant, which I haven't read, but is on my TBR. But yeah, I mean, after reading this, I definitely see why he's considered to be one of the greatest living authors of our time. And he's definitely an excellent writer. So, and I can definitely see like the kind of themes throughout the books that sort of, you know, reveal like what is really important to him in terms of, you know, just overall life philosophy and maybe concerns about the future. And I think he's just a really interesting person with some really super valid concerns about the direction in which things are going.
Well, that's like with Never Let Me Go. Mm-hmm. And then just based on your description of Claire in the Sun, because I haven't read it yet. But the thing for me is always like, he really wants you to think about what's ethical. Mm-hmm. But he wants you to understand, it seems like, that what is ethical is nuanced. And it's really hard to draw that line, especially when it comes to science, like messing with genes, messing with DNA, creating things in a lab. Like, and it's just crazy. I feel like he has to be some level of scientist, like on his own, like the way that he pays attention to that stuff or cares about that stuff, that has to be like his hobby or something, like where he's
Yeah, I don't think he, I've seen interviews with him and I don't think he does have a science background, but he is just very interested in these things and like, and how it kind of affects society.
Yeah, it's like we were just talking about the whole genetic, like choosing whether your kid has blue eyes, brown eyes, blonde mm-hmm. hair, whatever. And like, what is that called? There's a word for it, but where you mess with their DNA and take things away or add things, turn genes on and off, basically.
Yeah. Genetic altering, genetic.
It's basically eugenics, gene. But.
yeah, can be.
Depending on how far you take it. But we were talking about it in the sense that like in a lot of education articles and a lot of special ed articles and stuff, there's, you know, these two camps on whether or not Down syndrome should be a genetic right. modifier. Like if you have the opportunity to
eradicate, make that not like, yeah.
Yeah. And should it be, and yeah. I'm not going to say on which side I fall because that's a way too controversial for this
yeah.
particular podcast. But I do see that he kind of has those same like thoughts and conversations, like when those articles are released and you really have to ask yourself, like, what, how far is it okay to go for those yeah. things?
And like, so, what price are you willing to pay
for yeah. that? And why would you in some circumstances, like it, knowing, yeah, knowing the risks versus the reward and stuff like that, like how far? And he's so good at not answering that question for you in his books. Like you mm-hmm. have to come to your own conclusion, even though the book ends and you're devastated and there is an ending, you're like, well, damn it. He still doesn't tell you like how he really feels or which side he's on.
Right. And with that said too, like I did say that the bleakness level's on par with Never Let Me Go. I would say Never Let Me Go is a little more depressing than this. This isn't quite as depressing. Like it kind of, and again, like I think that kind of plays into like the whole youthful nature that this book sort of has. Like there's this undertone throughout it that's very because of the protagonist being an AI, I think that gives it like this very innocent feel. Like the way in which she describes everything, like she has this very, like the way she sees the world is very different. One of the reasons why it's called Clara and the Sun is because, or I guess the main reason, she believes that all like power is like solar. So like the sun is very important to her. She thinks that everybody's energy and health and all of that is very much dependent on the sun.
She's not wrong.
Yeah, she's not wrong. But there are times where it gets a little kind of like new agey. Like it seems like a little weird because you're like, wow, she's like really into this whole like sun thing, like harnessing the sun's energy. And again, I don't want to spoil anything, so I won't go too deep into her whole this theory that Clara basically has that the humans don't have. So that's kind of a big thing is that she has this theory that she thinks could basically save sick children like Josie. And I'll basically just leave it at that. But I think because it sort of has that that innocence to it, it's not quite as dark, but it's still sad. And it's a little maybe less sad because she is an AI.
Yeah.
But she's also, you know, she's the main character. You're seeing everything through her eyes. So obviously you become attached to her. And just the fact that she is so sweet and empathetic and, you know, caring and smart. Yeah.
It's so bad. And when you give like, gosh, what is that movie with Robin Williams where he's
I think it is just called like AI or something, isn't it?
It might be that could totally be correct. But
the one with like him and his wife and they like choose to die together at the end.
But it's that kind of thing. Once the person portraying the characters gives them human emotion ish even if it's just like human adjacent, right? It's not quite correct, but it's there. You can't think of them as anything but.
Wait, Bicentennial like, Man. That's what it was called, right?
All right. So not AI. So I wasn't like missing the easiest thing.
There were like a lot of them that came out around that time. But I think that's the one with Robin Williams in it. Anyway.
Yeah. But it was that kind of thing where you're just like, and then of course, like, oh my gosh, Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and that they don't even, I mean, you're always kind of wondering, is she or isn't she? Right. And that's an old ass movie, so I'm not spoiling anything for anyone. But she is, you know, you have to decide whether or not she counts as a person and it's okay, the things that happen to her. And
Star I'm Trek always like, with, why am I blanking on his name?
What, which thing? What'd you say?
The character from Star Trek, the, shit.
I'm not the one.
I cannot think of his name. Never mind.
Spock? No. That's the only person I know from Star Trek.
No, there's an AI on Next Generation. I don't know why I can't think of his name right now, but
Put it in the we'll put it in the notes when this gets posted so that
No, it's not that important.
Figured it out.
Everyone listening. Data, thank you. God. Took you long enough to jump in and save me there. Thanks.
I have a tattoo of him and you should know.
His name. You know, these things happen. Getting old, so what can I do?
I like how I'm just like, Spock is the only character on Star Trek. That's it. It's the only one.
Data, like a lot of the episodes on Next Gen, like deal with Data being AI. Like there's a lot of things that go into like the ethical dilemmas. Like, should he be treated as you know, I won't say human because they're like all different species and stuff like on that show, but should he be treated as, you know, like a sentient, whichever way you'd want to pronounce it. I think that is Captain Picard. Like always, he has the British, the British pronunciation of it. Whether or not he is a sentient being, basically.
Yeah. And Ishiguro, that seems like his thing. He really likes to play on that. And it makes for a good read, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, so. It definitely does. And I think, with like Remains of the Day, I didn't really get that as much, but it's definitely still there. Like there's still the whole theme of like, you know, choosing to kind of give up your, like making personal sacrifices, giving up your like personal happiness and basically the trade-offs. Decisions that we make through life, you know, for a bigger purpose or whatever our life philosophy is, like whether or not it's worth it. I wonder if it's more like Japanese literature too because of Ishiguro, because I feel like this is definitely a theme like in Japanese writing. And I watched an interview with him where he talks about that too. Like they just incorporate a lot more like philosophy into their novels, which I appreciate. So I like to think on that stuff as a former philosophy major once upon a time.
So. Philosophy was never my gig, but I like thinking about it. I do enjoy books that make you consider those things.
It's maddening, but
yeah.
Also interesting.
There's no hard and fast rules or outcome or anything. And you're just always arguing. It's like Chidi from The Good Place.
Yes.
Or you just like work yourself into insanity because you just can't.
I know. I related to that so hard and like how he eventually just died because he couldn't even make a simple decision. I was like, that's relatable. Like, I feel like that's how I'm going to go. I'm just going to be standing there trying to like figure something out and then.
You know. Left or right? I don't know. It's going to be center because I don't know. That's me.
Oh man. Yeah. And just like an old, like Looney Tunes cartoon, a piano will just fall.
Just anvils.
Yep.
Which again, like quicksand, not a thing. I mean, I really thought it was going to be an issue and it's just not like those.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen an anvil.
No, I was very scared of quicksand as a kid because it seemed to be in like every movie and cartoon. And I was like, at some point in my life, I'm going to encounter quicksand and I'm going to have to know not to try to struggle and to just let it you know,
happen.
Just to let it happen so that I'll be able to free myself. And I feel like we even talked about it in school as if they were like prepping us for the right. day that this would happen. And it never, I mean, knock on wood, no quicksand yet.
Especially like Never Ending Story, which is a movie that I hate that everybody else loves.
Do people really love it though? Or is it just like a nostalgic thing?
I don't know, but I don't even have nostalgia about it. I hated it when I was a kid. I hated it now. I'm not a fan. But when the horse is in the quicksand mm-hmm. and he's just like, I'm not even going to try.
Yeah.
I'm just going to stand here. And I'm like, well, that's what he was taught. We were all taught that. So the horse is not wrong. But
yeah,
my God, that's a devastating. I don't like that. That's probably the whole reason I didn't like the movie. I was just like, well, that's really sad. So I don't care for that.
Yeah. That's like me and the movie with Macaulay Culkin that everybody I've never seen.
Don't watch it.
Yeah, and I can't believe like I feel like my mom probably like purposely did not let me watch that movie because I would have been like devastated.
Yeah, severely traumatized. I'm pretty sure we all were. And I know that it's like trying to teach you
my
kids
girl
lessons.
That's what
like,
it's called, right?
My Girl. Yeah.
Yeah, My Girl.
But like where you have to learn to be. To deal with those things and be resilient. Mm. It's trying to tell you, like, prepare you that these things are going to happen. And I'm like, no.
Like, that's not a normal, like, thing that just happens in every kid's life.
Yeah. I'm going to watch The Labyrinth and pretend like goblins exist.
Yeah, that's, like, far more traumatizing than, like, what happens to most people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially at that age. At least we hope.
Yeah. Anyway. Should we take our break before we talk about the next book?
Quick break.
All right. Sounds good. And we're back to talk about The Clockmaker's Daughter by Kate Morton.
Yes, because Kate's book, House at Riverton, I should know, it's one of those, was one of my top ones from last year. Betty was my top, but she's a debut novelist, so there was nothing for me to continue with, so I chose Kate Morton. And this book, The Clockmaker's Daughter, is set in the summer of 1862, a group of young artists led by the passionate and talented Edward Radcliffe. Descend upon Birchwood Manor on the banks of the Upper Thames. There, they plan to spend a secluded summer month in a haze of inspiration and creativity. But by the time their stay is over, one woman has been shot dead while another has disappeared. A priceless heirloom is missing, and Edward's life is in ruins. So dramatic. Over 150 years later, Elodie Winslow, a young activist, she's an archivist in London, uncovers a leather satchel.
I don't remember an activist in there.
No. Uncovers a leather satchel containing two seemingly unrelated items, a photograph of an arresting looking woman in Victorian clothing and an artist's sketchbook containing the drawing of a twin gabled house on the bend of a river. Why does Birchwood Manor feel so familiar to Elodie? And who is the beautiful woman in the photograph? Okay. So I have thoughts. I really like...
What? I just realized that I jumped in to be like, I don't remember that. And I didn't even read this book. Like, what the hell am I talking about?
But I thought you just read a summary and you're like, or were reading along with me on Goodreads. And you were just like, that's not what that says. I thought you were just correcting me. So
for some reason, like my head was still like really much focused on the one that we read that you made me read last year. And so I was just thinking about that the entire time.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
No, but honestly, that's what I was getting ready to say, though. Like, I really like her writing. I think she is a really talented writer because I like really atmospheric, which is a word I use a lot to describe the books that I read, like setting and character building and stuff like that. I'm character driven novels and things like that. I really like. And so I really like her writing. But as I was reading this, I was like, this is the same book. And so I was like, I still gave it stars because it still interested me. I was still like fine with continuing to read it. I wanted to know what happened. I was interested and like
there for all of the characters. But it's like very formulaic in that House at Riverton was like the flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
Clockmaker's daughter has it starts with Elodie in present time and then it goes back. But it also switches, like, not just to artists. It's not just the two, even though that description makes it seem like here's this thing that happened and then here's Elodie. And then it's just going to be that. No, like, it's really about the house, Birchwood Manor. And so there are all these like different points of view that pop up and it all makes sense and you don't get lost in it or anything, but it's just like, through the years, she like tacked on a point of view to like fill the 150 year gap, basically.
Yeah.
To kind of show like what it's going to spoil it kind of. Because the house is important and the thing that happens at the house all the time is important. So you need to, she kind of did that to make you understand that this is a thing that's been continuously happening for 150 years. But yeah, it's a lot and it's a very thick book, like a House at Riverton. And so a lot goes on, a lot happens. It's mostly like, I mean, it's tragic, as was House at Riverton, where like some shit goes down. And it's the same kind of shit, because it's a lady who gets shot both times. Like, it's a dude that gets shot the first time, right? House of Riverton was that.
Yeah, first dude. First it was a guy, yeah.
Yeah. Somebody's always getting shot at some manor house somewhere. Like, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And then there's, like, family secrets and guilt and regret play, like, a huge part of this novel and, like, moving all of the characters forward. And it always, I wrote that like her novels always evoke feeling though. Like you have like an emotional reaction to whatever is happening. Just because I think she writes her characters so well. So like I said, even though it's like basically the same kind of formulaic, this is how I write kind of book. It's different enough. And you know, if you like historical fiction, like I like historical fiction, then it hits all the right notes in order to make you want to keep reading it. It reminded me a lot, like when I was reading it, I was seeing Atonement. It reminded me so much of that book and that film and the nuanced relationships and the reason certain things happen and the guilt and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's very similar.
Sorry, when I think of Atonement, all I think of now is Keira Knightley and that woman on TikTok that does the Keira Knightley acting videos.
Yes.
For anyone listening, if you haven't seen those, please go search for it because it's amazing.
It is amazing. But McAvoy, I was fine with picturing him as being the little crazy artist in the beginning. I was like, all right. So I have a note here and I'm not going to share it because I feel like it's going to spoil it. Like, I'm trying not to, I mean, we spoil a lot of books. It's fine. You are never going to read this. So I don't have to worry about it spoiling it for you.
No interest in reading it,
but somebody might like to read it.
And I feel like, from our book club, the other Kate Morton reader is Amanda. Shout out to Amanda. And I think that she has like literally read all of them. So she's probably read this already.
Yeah. And so Amanda's going to be like, I know what she's talking about. And like I said, I acknowledge that it's the same. I mean, she's telling the same story. I mean, I may have to pick up a third one.
That's kind of the thing with like these prolific authors that really are tied to like a specific genre like that. Like, I feel like she has this like brand of like pop historical fiction going on that sells, and she has a formula for that, so she can just crank them out quickly. I mean, no disrespect at all, like, to her, it's still difficult work, I'm sure, but I just think that's how some authors are able to churn out novel after novel like that.
Yeah. And even if it's 800 pages, because both of these books are like 800 pages, they are long books. And I've kind of figured out why these books appeal to me, and it's very snooty and ridiculous. I have a really hard time with the fact that people don't use vocabulary anymore. It's like the same seven words. Like, it's got to be short sentences. It's got to be the same. Like, and I really like someone who takes time to write a complex sentence and, you know, and uses words that you don't.
Prose.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I like the, I also like short sentences and fun. I like it all. But I think the reason I get attached to books like that is just because that's the only place I see that kind of language. It's like, because it's flowery.
People are, I was going to say that bothers some people. They just want you to get to the point.
Right.
Instead of being so descriptive about things. But I know you like the, you like all the detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the words. and of course, I think that, and I like heavy science fiction too, like, you know, Philip K. Dick and things like
that. Which can also be very descriptive. Like that's kind of, that's like the sci-fi that isn't Ishiguro's kind of sci-fi. It's like the way more like world building, like there's a lot more focus on like setting up the atmosphere and all of that. So that, you know, if there were, you know, if they do create like a movie adaptation or something, there's not going to be a lot of, what's the word? You can't, the director or whoever, you know, when they're coming up with this vision, they can't take a lot of liberties with it. Like they kind of have to go with what was written.
Cause if they don't, the readers get really like, we get angry about it, but that's, So and I think the reason I really liked House at Riverton last year and everything, like I very rarely find books where this kind of, that's not really how people write anymore. I mean, it's its own kind of thing, and it can be done poorly. And I think that's where I was like, oh, well, this is done well. And it's, but now I'm like, I probably don't need to read any of her other books. Cause it's the same book. Same like, and that's like the 13th Tale is like my, one of my most favorite books of all time. And then Hurt, that author's, dang, what is her name? Why can't I think of her name? Doesn't matter. 13th Tale, the author of that book. Her two other books, it's like her style of writing, but they're very, very different. They're significantly different books. So like I really enjoyed those three.
Diane Setterfield?
Setterfield, yeah. But so hers, like she does, she has that same kind of narrative style. But her three books were vastly different. So it didn't feel like I was just reading the same thing, you know. So yeah, so for me, whereas you really appreciated and continue to appreciate your author from last year, I'm like, eh, take it or leave it. Like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I had a hit and a miss, I think. I mean, I wouldn't call The Remains of the Day like a total miss for me, but it also was like, it was a DNF at one point. And then I was just like, you know what, this isn't that long of a book. And I should just push through it and finish it and see, who knows, maybe there's like some crazy twist because you never know with them. And then, like after reading Claire in the Sun, I was like, okay, now I remember why I like his work. So I will.
And was The Remains of the Day before Never Let Me Go?
I think so, but I am not positive about that. Let's see. Never Let Me Go came out in 2005. So I'm going to guess that Remains of the Day came out first, which there is also a movie adaptation to Remains of the Day, which I haven't seen and I didn't really know existed.
I know that movie. I've never seen it, but people talk about it and it's like, I've heard it a thousand times. I've heard people talk about that, but I don't.
I think the movie came out in the early 90s and didn't have, who was in it? I can picture the guy from like Anthony Hopkins.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Anthony Hopkins played the butler, which makes him seem like even more, like sinister.
Yeah.
Because I can't see Anthony Hopkins as anything but like evil.
I can see him as Thor's dad. So that kind of helped me.
That's what almost like, now I'm kind of curious though, the movie might make it more interesting because maybe him playing the character might make it a little more.
It could be.
Yeah, like a little more, like he's not just like aloof, but also kind of a dick.
Just remains of the day, 1989.
Yeah, 1989. So, yeah, so that, I think that was probably one of his first books, if not his first book.
I was just thinking in like timeline order, that mm-hmm. might be why that one was a miss for you and the other two were. Hits.
That's true. I mean, that would explain like there's more similarity between the more recent ones. And I've heard The Buried Giant also has a similar like dystopian feel to it. So he must have kind of, you know, somewhere along the way in his writing journey honed in on that.
Yeah.
Let's see. When did The Buried Giant come out? Just out of curiosity, because I think that looks like that came out in 2015. Okay, so that was right before he won the Nobel Prize.
Okay.
So that would be the most, I think that's the most recent, aside from this Claire and the Sun.
Then that makes sense.
Yeah. That looks interesting as well.
Real quick before we keep going, on our break, Mr. Producer, had a fun fact about quicksand. And I feel like we need to know it.
Well, fact may be a little strong of a word because I was looking up this so-called fact of mine and I can't necessarily find the proof of it, but
I'm shocked that it was, that you can't find
that doesn't proof. Mean that proof doesn't exist. And I'll explain why in a minute, but I remember years ago reading or hearing there's probably multiple lists out there, but somebody does a list of like the top fears of like a generation or a country, or, you know, there's probably all kinds of different demographics, but I remember hearing that quicksand was for years was consistently in like the top five fears of Americans.
Which is bizarre.
It was like public speaking, you know, snakes, spiders, you know, common stuff, and then quicksand. And it's because of how prominent it was in movies and television.
Yeah,
and
pop culture.
If you look it up now, what you're going to find is a bunch of articles about how it used to be super big in movies and TV and how a lot of people used to be afraid of it. And it's not so much anymore. You know, there's a bunch of stuff out there about that, but so I couldn't exactly find the exact, you know, poll or whatever, but I remember hearing it. I mean, it could have been on the radio. It could have been something I read.
Where does quicksand even exist?
Very few places. And when you look it up, I couldn't even find a name for the fear of quicksand because that's how uncommon it is. So there's a name for a fear of walking on sand and they kind of use that for the fear of quicksand.
Yeah, that's totally different though, because that would be more of like someone who doesn't like the feeling of it or the heat.
I'm sure there's a name for it, but when you search for it, the first things that come up are not actually fear of quicksand. So I'm sure there's a name, but that's how uncommon quicksand is. It's extremely uncommon. And that's what, it's a very irrational fear, but man, they love to put it in movies and television and cartoons and things. And
I just looked
there's entire generations of people that are terrified of quicksand.
Well, apparently it exists in Southern California, according to the internet. So I guess it does exist some places in the US.
Well, I just looked up and it's like the definition of where it can be found. Quicksand can be found in places where there is grainy soil, including riverbanks, marshes, lake shores, beaches, and areas near underground springs. So everywhere.
Yeah.
That can be found everywhere.
But I think quicksand deep enough to actually like engulf a human being is extremely rare. Because those riverbanks and things, you're going to sink like a foot, you know, like it might cover your shoes up.
Right. This is interesting though. I found this news article from this woman who was walking her horse.
And, oh no!
Yeah,
as you do.
It is the actual never-ending story. I'm going to be upset.
Yeah, and it says that she found patches of quicksand for about 30 feet. said we were surrounded by quicksand. I mean, it doesn't say that anything happened, though.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Honestly, Indiana Jones for me. Like, I grew up with Indiana Jones, and there's quicksand, and it messed me. I was afraid of quicksand too.
Quicksand and Jumanji. Like, I mean, like, isn't all Jumanji? Of our,
yeah.
Like,
okay, this says if quicksand isn't shallow enough for you to hit bottom, you'd eventually float because, you're not as why did it just refresh all of a sudden? That's nice. Because you're not as dense as the sand. So it's not like movies where they show nothing but a hat left, is what this person was saying.
But what if you're floating? What if it gets above your head and that's when you start to float? Like, right? I don't know. I need to actually have this conversation. I'm never going to run into quicksand, but.
It does say that someone was stuck for 12 hours in quicksand near this lake in the 90s, in this lake in Southern California.
Think how much media it was in, though. Like Princess Bride,
everything.
Neverending Story, yeah. Star Wars.
I'm sure it was in Indiana
I think it's actually
Jones,
the new Star Wars like, movies.
Apparently it was in Tarzan. Yeah.
I remember it in like Johnny Quest cartoons.
Wild West, like Western movies. Like there was always quicksand. Like,
oh, yeah. Yep.
It was crazy. It was like literally in everything. Like there wasn't like some kind of any adventure movie you watch had some kind of quicksand scene in it.
But isn't it interesting how it's a lot of the time it's like the quicksand is in the desert. But in that article that I was reading, I like the definition.
It would be near like
it has to be near water.
Water. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Which makes more sense. I think a lot of times it was like in jungles too. Like it makes more sense for me to see it in like Tarzan or like Princess Bride. I don't know where they are in that movie, but they're running through the woods, which makes it seem a little more like realistic that they might encounter it. But
is the Neverending Story like in real life? Like I hated that movie so much that my memories of it are, we do call our dog Luck Dragon, but that's about as far as,
I could be wrong, but I believe your husband very much liked that movie.
He really did. He loved it.
That movie takes place in a book. You guys, you two should love it. It's kind of like, it's like,
just because it takes
although to be fair, that. Just because you like books. Well, and to be fair, most movies like that are actually not very good. I mean, Pagemaster did not stand the test of time either.
We had this discussion in a Facebook chat recently.
Old
nostalgic movies that did not hold up.
Yeah.
Yep. Used to love that one.
All right. Is it game time?
What are we playing today?
For your listeners, this is new for season two. We're going to end each episode with a game. I have lots of game ideas. Melinda and Allie do not know the game they're about to play. Some games involve future reading. Some games are just for fun. It's at my whim. This is where I exert my power.
Where you get back at us for all the hours of editing.
Not that I've earned that power at all, but yes, it's my reward for editing.
So, so the games will get more cruel if we mess up more and you have to do more edits. I get
if I continue
no, no,
to
no,
mess up
the
recording, Ryder's gonna be like,
that's
it's a hard game this week.
No, we're gonna play. We are gonna play a future reading game this time. So. I've nicknamed this one Jump the Queue, and it's kind of a reverse of the old Trash the TBR thing you guys used to do. So what this game is going to be is you're going to look at each other's TBR lists, and you're going to pick a book that it has to be the next read off the TBR list for the other person. So it has to be from their list. So, you know, you can't suggest a book that's not there, but you're going to pick one that's the next read. And then on a upcoming episode, you guys will give your take on that book. So,
do we pick it on air?
Yep.
Okay.
You're going to pick it right now.
All right. I love how I say on air and, as if we're live, like on the radio or something.
Yeah. Yep. We're all today. Your listeners
you
are going to sit here
like,
and wait.
I just like aged 10 years overnight. I don't know what is going on with me today, but I'm just like in full on grandma mode. I'll be doing this live on air.
You're the youngest one here, and you're like, I'm 84.
I don't know what's wrong with me today. All right. Let's see. Let me get to Melinda's Goodreads here.
Yeah, it's going to be easier for you because mine is at 2,000 books to pick from.
Yeah, whatever you feel like is an appropriate amount of time, Melinda, to choose the Jump the Queue book for Allie. I don't expect you to do a comprehensive evaluation of her list.
I think you can sort the list too, which might make it easier. Like if you want to sort it by like date added or something, maybe it might let you do that.
Yeah, I think it does. And it lets you do it by like number of ratings and
yeah,
that kind of stuff. So
that would be good. Let's see. Sort it by.
Dude, I already know.
You already know. Oh my God.
I already know.
Oh.
Because I'm mad. I'm mad that it's here.
Oh, so fast. You're mad?
I saw that coming. I knew Melinda would see a book that she is upset that you hadn't read yet and would be like, that's the book.
Is that the reason, though? You're mad that I haven't read it yet?
Yeah.
Oh, what is it? Well,
that's fine.
Or should we wait?
I was going to say.
Let's wait.
Okay.
Let's wait and we'll reveal at the same time.
Oh, okay.
There's multiple strategies here. See, that's what makes it a game, right? It's not a task, it's a game. So you could pick something that you've enjoyed, or you could be mean and pick something you didn't enjoy, or you could pick something you're curious about but don't want to take a risk on, so you make her read it first. Mm-hmm. I mean,
I like this.
There's multiple strategies here.
They're good strategies. Maybe I should make her finish this one, or not finish. Make her read this one so she's finishing it for you.
Oh.
You didn't finish it.
Oh, another a strategy out of left field, bringing Mr. Producer into the fold even more.
Yeah, maybe I should.
I think I know what that pick is.
Yeah. The thing is, though, I don't think you own this book, though, Melinda, so.
That's okay.
It's going to be
depressing. How often do I stick to not buying books? Never. So I'll buy it.
Yeah, I've realized that I actually thought about that earlier today as I thought about this, doing this game. I was like, well, this is going to encourage them to buy even more books.
Yeah, good job. Which
I'm sure, you know, the significant others in this scenario are going to be happy about that. But you know what? It makes for good content. So we're moving ahead with it.
Honestly, you should be happy because it's been a while since I bought books. I've been pretty good lately.
It has been.
Yeah.
It has been. All right. Do you both have your picks?
I think so. I mean, I could spend forever like analyzing this list, but
yeah.
Sure. Sure.
But if we're just going to go,
well, I'm sure we'll play this.
My first thought.
I'm sure we'll play this multiple times. Okay. So, you know, Melinda, you had yours first. So what book is jumping the queue for Allie?
Okay. It depends. I'm having a moment where it depends.
You didn't actually pick one. You picked two.
I did. I picked two. I picked more than one, so that's actually overachieving. No, so okay. Have you seen The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? The movie?
Yes. So here's my history with that movie. I used to work at a movie theater when I was in high school, and that was actually my first job ever. Fun fact. And I think that movie came out at the time I was working at the movie theater. And so during that time, I kind of would just like walk in and out and watch movies like while I was working.
Amazing.
Which is fine.
Yep.
I was just cool with it. So I did kind of see that. I don't think I like sat there and watched the whole thing. And I also think I didn't really enjoy it or appreciate it at the time. So
okay.
That.
Okay, so I love The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I've read all of them.
I know you do.
Yes, I'm a huge fan. So,
no offense, but I feel like the fans are kind of annoying about it.
Oh,
so I think that's why I don't want to like it.
I just appreciated it. I didn't read it until I was in college. I'd never read sci-fi in my life until I got to college and I had to take a class, and it was an elective, and it was science fiction. And it was the first one I ever picked up. It was what was assigned, and I read it, and it's so funny because it's satire and it's just silly and it's just a funny read. And so I really liked it because it was humor, et cetera. But I also noticed that you haven't read Dune. That's a massive book.
God, that book's huge. And I do want to read it. Like, it is on my TBR and I own it. Like, I bought a really awesome copy of it which it's beautiful. Like the book, yeah. the version I bought, but like, I have no idea. And I wanted to read it before the movie comes out, which I don't even know when that's happening now. I think it's this fall, right?
Soon.
Yeah.
Soon.
I don't know if I can read that.
Yeah, it's a massive book. It's a lot. That's a huge ask. So,
I don't know.
You can do it. You can do it. Yeah, I didn't put a timeline on these. It's just, it does have, it's jumping the queue. So it needs to go on to your,
before the next episode.
Well,
that'd be great.
Ideally, you would read it within like the next couple episodes. Okay. Like it doesn't have to be the next episode, the next couple, but you know, if you're giving a book that is extremely long,
yeah,
you know, maybe we could extend the timeline on it because it is a hefty boy.
It is. And I will say this, I saw many books I'm shocked you haven't read, but I also would throw out The Importance of Being Earnest because you liked Picture of Dorian Gray.
Oh yeah.
Oh
yeah.
The goal here was to pick one book that jumps the queue, and you've now put out three. So I don't think you quite understand the rules here.
I follow the rules. I'm too nice. I only picked one.
I'm sorry.
Okay, hold on. Before we move on, we've got to narrow it down to one. Okay. So Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Dune. Or The Importance of Being Earnest. I kind of want to make you read Dune. I really do. It's really long. So you just really have to say if you don't think that you can read it.
I mean, I think I can read it. I know I can read it and I want to read it. It's just like, I don't know how fast I can read it.
Oh yeah. That's what I mean. Like if you,
that's okay.
Yeah.
It'll take a while. We'll just bug you.
That movie adaptation the other day that we tried to watch. That was terrible.
Yeah. So bad. It's
the old movie.
I love Kyle MacLachlan and I love, what's his face? The director. I'm a massive Twin Peaks fan. I love the weirdness and I appreciate the artfulness of what he does, but we could not finish that movie. Right. It was so dull. It was just so boring.
David, what's that guy's name? David Lynch. Yeah.
David Lynch. Thank you. Okay. So Dune for Allie. We'll give her more time to read it.
Good luck to me.
I love the idea of you reading more sci-fi. So perfect. Dune it is. Okay. Right. Allie, what is jumping the queue for Melinda?
The Bees. By Lailene Paul, I believe is how you say her name. This is on Melinda's TBR, and it is a book that we own, and Roderick started to read it like last summer, actually. I think it's literally been a year almost because we were, I think, like on vacation in the Outer Banks, and I remember you were still reading it, and then you just set it down after that and never finished it.
You know what happened was book club got in the way, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean I was prioritizing book club books, and that kept getting put off. And there was a couple months where I was reading both, but it just I never finished. I probably got a third or maybe more through that book, but I was very much enjoying it. It's really different and really interesting. And once you get past the science side of it, which isn't important to the book, but the author uses actual scientific terms to refer to things.
So you got to learn the book.
And so
great.
you don't even really need to, as long as you can associate, like, not to give too much away, and I'm not part of this podcast from a reading standpoint, but like it's from what I gather, and again I haven't finished it, but it's definitely a commentary on like a class system, which is essentially how beehives function too.
Yeah.
But she integrates an actual like kind of human based class system into the book, but she refers to them in like scientific terms. Like I don't remember the terms, but right. Like the different
species of bees, like they're not worker species, and queen, but like
species and the jobs they do and all these things. You know, it's really interesting. Like each family is born into a class, but the family is named after like something they used to pollinate down in their line. So like you might be like the Lavender Clan because
it's
kind of like how last name started, like Smith was.
Yeah,
like
you were, it you is. Know, like a, it's very interesting book. I was very much enjoying it. So
I'm excited because it's a pretty one.
It is really pretty.
I love the cover of that one. So
it's a very pretty book, and I feel like it'll be kind of interesting to hear your perspective, because we'll both be reading sci-fi, but I'll be reading a classic, whereas you'll be reading new sci-fi.
Oh yeah.
So I feel like kind of turns the tables on us a bit, because
yeah,
I'm usually the one reading the newer sci-fi stuff, and you're the sci-fi classic gal.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Randomly, I was like forced into it.
All right. Perfect. So our first game ever. Jump the queue. Right. Allie is going to read Dune, and Melinda is going to read The Bees.
Send me awesome. Your thoughts and prayers, everyone.
Sympathies for Allie.
Gotta put that audiobook at 1.5, so 1.5 to speed through it.
I could have the help of the audiobook. I didn't even think of that. Yeah, that might help me. All right.
Okay.
So, I think that brings us to the end of today's podcast, our first episode of season 2. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. Make sure to go follow us on Instagram at Novels with Nightcaps, and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and leave us a review if you can. It really helps us out. And if you'd like to read along with us in our book club, you can learn more about the book club and join us at booksbrunch.com and books at brunch with books on Instagram. Also, if you have a suggestion of books for us to read, or you just want to drop us a line, you can shoot us a message on Instagram or send us an email at info@novelswithnightcaps.com. Or this is fun, you can even leave us a voice message at anchor.fm/novelswithnightcaps. Melinda's nephew did this. So
I was going to say, and then we both had panic attacks because this is not age appropriate.
That's what we've gotten so far though. So, I mean, no pressure guys, but I got real excited. And then I was like, oh, it's just Melinda's nephew. I'm just kidding. I mean, it was still fun.
Yeah. He's cute, but it was nothing about books. And he literally just said hello to me and not Allie. So
hello, Mimi.
I love it.
All right. Cheers, guys. Until next time.